So, when you look at a diamond ring or, maybe just a chunk of quartz sitting on your desk, you tend to see perfection.
Right, you see that absolute clarity.
Exactly. It looks like this this endless, flawless, repeating pattern of atoms that just extends out into infinity.
And it's comforting. It feels really solid.
It does. But it is a beautiful lie, or, well, at least a very specific exception to the general rule.
Yeah, because if you look at the steel in your car's chassis or the aluminum in a soda can, that perfection just doesn't exist.
It really doesn't. Real-world materials are what we call polycrystalline, which is basically a fancy way of saying they are a mess.
They're a crowd. It's a bunch of tiny crystals all jammed together, shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, and that is exactly where things get interesting, because we aren't actually looking at the crystals themselves today. We're looking at the borderlands.
The microscopic no man's land, that space where two crystals meet, clash, and basically try to figure out how to coexist. Right, we are exploring the interface. And the core question for today's deep dive is simple but profound. What actually happens at that boundary?
Right. When two perfectly ordered crystal grids collide at some weird angle, does it just become a chaotic jumble of atoms? Or is there, a hidden geometric order to the mess?
And to find out, we are digging into Chapter 7 of Geometry of Crystals, Polycrystals, and Phase Transformations.
By HKDH Padatia.
Exactly. We'll be talking about his insights on atomic wedges, secret ghost grids, and why nature seems to have a favorite angle.
Specifically 36.9 degrees, which sounds crazy specific.
It sounds totally obscure, I know. But this geometry dictates whether a bridge holds up or
Yeah,
collapses.
the properties of a material, how it bends, how it breaks, and especially how it rusts, are almost always decided right there at the border.
So let's zoom in, way, way in, down to the atomic level. Imagine you have crystal A on the left and crystal B on the right.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
They are growing toward each other, but they are tilted differently. Their internal grids don't align. What happens when they finally touch?
I mean, I guess they have an identity crisis. You get this incredibly narrow region where the atoms don't really know which crystal they belong to.
That's a great way to put it. The long-range order of crystal A stops, and crystal B hasn't quite started yet. It's a fundamental disruption.
So does that mean the atoms in that gap are just sort of floating around in a void?
Not a void, no, but definitely a bad fit zone. The density in this interface region is actually lower than in the rest of the bulk crystal.
Because the atoms can't pack together as tightly when the grids don't line up perfectly.
Exactly. They're forced into awkward compromises, and that lower density has massive practical consequences.
Lower density usually means weakness, doesn't it?
It means vulnerability. Because there is more empty space between the atoms, things can move around. Diffusion happens much faster along these
Oh,
boundaries.
right. And impurities like stray atoms of dirt or other elements, they get trapped in there.
Yeah, it's like the crack in the sidewalk where all the weeds grow.
And weeds, in this metallurgical context, mean corrosion.
Ideally, yes. Padatia makes a really strong point here in the text. If that boundary is coherent, meaning the atoms manage to line up somewhat decently, despite the mismatch, the material holds together well.
But if it's just a chaotic mess, it's basically a superhighway for rust.
Exactly. The corrosion resistance of a metal depends heavily on how messy these borders are. Nature really wants to minimize that mess.
So let's try to visualize how it actually does that.
Yeah.
The source walks us through this great thought experiment called the symmetrical tilt boundary.
Right, the wedge model.
Walk me through it. I'm picturing a single perfect block of crystal.
Okay, visualize that block. Now I want you to slice it perfectly in half down the middle.
Okay, so I have two identical halves.
Now rotate or tilt those two halves away from each other just a little bit. Let's say by an angle of theta, maybe just 5 degrees.
All right, I've tilted them. But if I try to push them back together now, they aren't going to sit flush anymore. I basically made a V-shaped gap between them, like opening a book.
Exactly. But here's the problem. You can't have a giant triangular hole inside a solid block of steel.
Right, the atoms have to touch.
Nature abhors a vacuum, especially in a solid crystal.
So how do you close that V shape without just bending the crystals back to their original position?
You jam something in there. Nature inserts what we call edge dislocations.
Just dislocations.
Think of it like a deck of playing cards. If you want to fan the cards out to create a tilt, you can't just bend the cards themselves.
Oh, they decrease.
Right. But if you shove an extra half card in between the others, it forces the deck to splay open.
Oh, I see. So an edge dislocation is basically an atomic wedge. It's an extra half plane of atoms just forced directly into the lattice.
That is exactly it. These wedges accommodate the tilt. And the really cool thing here is that it's not random at all.
There's a geometry to it.
A perfect mathematical relationship. The spacing of these wedges, let's call that spacing D, is directly related to the tilt angle, theta.
The source gives a specific formula for this, right?
Yes. It's the tangent of theta over 2 equals b over 2d.
And b is the Burgers vector.
Exactly. The Burgers vector essentially represents the magnitude of the distortion caused by one wedge.
So the takeaway is that the misorientation isn't just smeared evenly across the whole boundary. It's localized.
Highly localized. It's periodic defects.
So it's like perfect crystal, bam,
yeah.
Wedge, perfect crystal, bam, wedge.
And between those wedges, the fit is actually perfect. The crystals don't even realize they are misaligned because the wedge took the bullet, so to speak.
It absorbed the distortion.
Yes.
But I can see a fairly obvious problem here. That model makes total sense for a small tilt, but what if I crank that angle open?
Mm-hmm.
What if I tilt the crystals 10, 20, or 30 degrees apart?
Well, according to the math, you need more wedges.
And eventually you just run out of room.
That is the breaking point. As the angle theta gets larger, those dislocations get packed closer and closer together to accommodate the steeper tilt.
And what happens when they get too close?
Eventually, the cores of the dislocations overlap. You literally cannot distinguish one wedge from another anymore.
So the whole wedge model just collapses. It just becomes a solid wall of distortion.
For a very long time, that is exactly what people thought happened. They assumed that high-angle boundaries were just chaotic, disordered, high-energy disasters.
But Hadashia highlights this massive aha moment in Chapter 7. When the wedge model fails, nature actually switches strategies.
It does. It stops trying to fix the gap with wedges, and it finds a new pattern entirely.
Yes, this was the part of the text that really blew my mind. It's all about finding order in high-angle chaos.
Welcome to the world of the coincidence site lattice, or CSL for short.
CSL. Okay, it helps me to stop thinking about wedges here and start thinking about rhythm.
Rhythm is a great analogy.
Imagine two different grids, grid A and grid B. They're rotated so they don't line up at all. It looks like a total mess. But if you step back and look at the big picture, every once in a while, a point from grid A lands exactly on top of a point from grid B.
It's like two drummers playing different time signatures.
Yes. One is playing a fast beat, the other is playing a slow beat. Most of the time, they're totally out of sync.
But every few bars, they hit the snare at the exact same time.
That's the perfect way to visualize it. And those moments where they hit the snare together, that is a coincidence site.
And if you connect all of those matching points, you get a new, larger grid superimposed over the chaos, the super lattice.
And this is where that term sigma comes in, right? You see it all over material science papers, sigma 3, sigma 5. It's basically just counting the beats.
Effectively, yes. Sigma represents the reciprocal density of those coincidence sites.
Reciprocal density, meaning?
Meaning if one out of every five lattice points matches up perfectly, that is a sigma 5 boundary.
Okay, got it. And if one out of every three matches?
Then it's a sigma 3.
So a lower sigma number is actually better.
Usually, yes. A lower sigma means the beats match up more often. The coincidence is higher. There is more physical overlap between the two crystal lattices.
And because there is more overlap, the boundary has lower energy. It's more stable.
It's happier, chemically speaking. The volume of the CSL unit cell is simply sigma times the volume of the original crystal cell. Nature vastly prefers the rhythm of a sigma 3 or a sigma 5 over the chaos of a random mismatch.
Which brings us to that magic angle I teased at the beginning of the show.
Oh.
36.9 degrees.
Right.
It seems so incredibly random. Why that specific number?
It's not random at all when you look at the geometry. If you take two primitive cubic lattices, think of simple 3D scaffolding grids, and you rotate one of them around a specific axis.
So the text mentions the 100 axis, right?
Yes, the 100 axis. Yeah. If you rotate it by exactly 36.9 degrees, the math magically aligns to create a beautiful sigma 5 pattern.
So at 35 degrees, it's a mess. At 37 degrees, it's a mess. But at exactly 36.9.
Everything clicks. One in five atoms locks into place.
And what does that actually do to the material in the real world? If I have a piece of metal full of these 36.9 degree boundaries, how does it behave?
It behaves like a fortress. These special CSL boundaries are incredibly stubborn. They exhibit strong faceting, and they have very low mobility.
Meaning they don't slide around or deform easily under stress.
Exactly. They are mechanically rigid.
And what about the corrosion we talked about earlier?
Vastly improved. Hadashia notes that the diffusion coefficients in these specific boundaries are abnormally small.
Because the atoms are locked tightly into this shared superlattice.
Yes, there just aren't as many open lanes or gaps for oxygen or rust to sneak through.
It's a sealed border.
A border with a very strict checkpoint system.
Now, obviously, material scientists aren't measuring these microscopic atomic angles with a tiny protractor.
Mm.
The source dives into some pretty heavy linear algebra here to explain how this is calculated.
It does. Lots of matrices and coordinate transformations. It is very easy to get lost in the mathematical notation.
So how do I break that down?
Think of the math as a translator.
A translator, right.
So you have crystal A speaking one language, let's say, defining its atomic coordinates in terms of its own basis A.
Right.
And crystal B speaks another language, basis B. The rotation matrix is just the dictionary that translates a vector from crystal A's language into crystal B's language.
And the test for whether a boundary is special or not, whether it has a good sigma value, comes down to that translation.
Exactly. We use what's called a matrix test. You take a primitive lattice vector from crystal A, run it through the rotation matrix to translate it, and then multiply it by your proposed sigma value.
And if the result comes out as whole numbers integers, then congratulations, you found a CSL boundary.
Precisely. For example, if you do a 180-degree rotation around the 112 axis, the matrix math reveals a perfect sigma 3 value. We often call that a twin boundary.
But if you run the test and it comes out as fractions or decimals,
then the points don't align, the drummers are never hitting the beat together, it's just a general high-angle boundary.
You know, there was one specific proof in that section that I found strangely philosophical. The whole idea of invariant vectors.
Ah, example 7.1.
Yeah. It basically proves mathematically that the magnitude, the length of a vector doesn't change just because you switch coordinate systems from A to B.
It sounds totally obvious when you say it out loud, doesn't it? If I hold up a pencil, it doesn't suddenly get shorter just because you walk to the other side of the room to look at it.
Right, but in the rigorous math of crystallography, proving that is absolutely essential.
It is. It confirms that the vector is a physical reality. The coordinate system is just a map we draw over it to help us understand it.
The map might change depending on which crystal you're standing in, but the territory remains the same.
Exactly. The physics don't change just because our point of view does.
So we have the theory down. We know that at low angles, nature uses wedges. At high angles, we look for these special sigma rhythms. But how do we actually find them in the real world today? Because we certainly aren't slicing crystals by hand.
No, we have robots and very expensive microscopes for that now. In modern tech, we use something called orientation imaging inside a scanning electron microscope, or CM.
Oh, this is that incredibly colorful map I've seen in material science textbooks, right?
Right.
Where the grains look like a bright stained glass window.
That's the exact one. The electron beam scans across the surface of the metal, figures out the precise crystallographic orientation of every single grain, and then the software automatically calculates the boundary between them.
So it just paints a line and says, hey, this is a sigma 3, or this one over here is a sigma 29.
Yes, it's highly automated.
It sounds perfect. It's just automated discovery of all these special properties.
It sounds perfect, but this is exactly where Padeshia throws up a giant stop sign in the text.
He does give a pretty stern expert warning.
He warns us to take these automated CM maps with a massive pinch of salt.
Why, though? If the rotation matrix math works, why shouldn't we trust the map the software generates?
Because of the so what factor. The software will happily identify a sigma 41 boundary for you, meaning one out of every 41 atoms matches up.
And mathematically, that is a coincidence, sight lattice. It's a match.
Mathematically, yes, but physically. Think about it. If you and I are holding hands to form a strong bond, but we are standing 41 people apart in a crowd, are we really connected in a meaningful way?
Not really. The line is just way too thin. The connection is too sparse.
Exactly. And that distinction is crucial for engineers to understand. Large sigma values like sigma 29 or sigma 41 or higher are essentially meaningless in the physical world.
Because the points of coincidence are just so far apart that the boundary doesn't even feel the order.
Right. It behaves exactly like a random, chaotic, high-energy mess.
So the software is technically correct, but practically, it's lying to you about the material's properties.
It's giving you data that doesn't actually matter for engineering. The special properties we want, the high corrosion resistance, the abnormal diffusion, the mechanical strength, those really only kick in when the fit is tight.
Like sigma 3, sigma 5, maybe up to sigma 7.
Yeah. Beyond that, the physical benefit of coincidence just fades away completely.
That is such a critical nuance. Just because a computer can slap a sigma label on a boundary doesn't mean it's actually a special boundary.
That is the danger of relying purely on mathematical modeling without grounding it in physics. You can model a relationship that is mathematically true, but so incredibly faint that it has zero impact on reality.
You always have to remember the atoms.
Always.
But let's look at the flip side of this for a minute. If we can identify the good ones, the tight sigma 3s and 5s, and we know they make the metal super strong and corrosion resistant, can we force the material to make more of them?
Now you're talking about the holy grail of modern metallurgy. It's a field called grain boundary engineering.
Grain boundary engineering. Sounds like terraforming, but for a block of metal.
It basically is. The entire idea is to process the material to heat it, squeeze it, anneal it in very specific controlled ways to maximize the population of these special low sigma boundaries.
So instead of a random cast block where maybe 10% of the boundaries are strong, you try to engineer it so 80 or 90% are sigma 3s and 5s.
Exactly. Imagine a car chassis made of steel where almost every single internal grain boundary is a highly ordered CSL boundary.
It wouldn't rust.
It would be incredibly resistant to degradation. Or think about a jet engine turbine blade. You want that to be virtually immune to creep.
Creep is that slow deformation that happens to metals at really high temperatures, right?
Yes. If you can lock the internal boundaries of that alloy with CSL patterns, the material stays rigid even under extreme thermal stress.
It is genuinely amazing to think that the difference between a rusty bucket and a high-performance aerospace alloy isn't necessarily the atoms themselves.
No.
It's not about just changing iron to titanium and hoping for the best. It's purely about the geometry of how those identical atoms shake hands at the borders.
It is entirely about the relationship between the crystals. You can have the best, purest ingredients in the world, but if the interface between them is chaotic, the whole structure eventually fails.
But if the interface is ordered, it endures.
It endures. Mm. Nature really does hide its best secrets in the cracks.
It really does. And the math, the tangent formulas, the matrices, the sigma values, that's just our way of learning to read the map that nature already drew.
Perfectly said.
Well, I'm certainly going to look at a galvanized chain link fence a little differently now.
Mm.
I'll be staring at it, wondering about the sigma values holding the zinc together.
Just don't trust the sigma 41s.
I promise I won't. Thanks for taking us through the borderlands today. It's been a fascinating deep dive into the hidden geometry of the solid world.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And to everyone listening, keep digging. There's always a deeper order to find if you just know the right angle to look from. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.